Get ready. You'll be on another adventure with Andrew Rennie and The Space Show.
As Sandra said, though, this is The Space Show. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. And here is something for your diary. This number, 9088646666. I'll say that again, 9088646666. Now, just keep that number handy. You might want to use it later in the show. On this evening's The Space Show, we have a book review, news of two rocket launches in South Australia, and part three of our Planet Earth documentary series. But first up, the book review. And Spacefarers is a book by Christopher Wanjek. In 347 easy-to-read pages, he explains how humans will settle the moon and beyond. Now, joining us on the telephone is Peter Owen from the Space Association of Australia, president of that association. Welcome to The Space Show, Peter.
Thank you, Andrew. Good evening, Andrew, and good evening, listeners.
Yes. Now, I understand you've read, as I have, you've read the book. And you're going to tell us a little bit about it.
Sure, yeah. So let's start off with what this book is. It, as you mentioned, it's called Spacefarers. And the author's name is Christopher Wanjet. And he, among other things, has worked for NASA as one of their writers and consultants on various projects. He's produced other books on other subjects, but he's really focused in hard on this particular challenge, which I guess the premise really of what he starts out with is basically we've been in space for 60 plus years. We visited the moon 50 odd years ago, but essentially the challenges for possibilities of living in space are still there. We hardly have anyone living in space. There's the International Space Station, of course, but we've whizzed around in low Earth orbit for 50 odd years. And he sort of questions the reasons why and gives some fairly even-handed view of the challenges, and as we all know, there are many, but also some of the strategies and opportunities by which we could make it a feasible option to be living, working on a short-term basis, but also on a long-term basis, because particularly if you're going to go deep spaces, which is something he does progress out to, he talks about the moon. He then goes on to Mars and beyond. And in fact, he goes to every planet in the solar system, and including a few moons and asteroids. So he goes in quite deeply towards the end of the book on the challenges and opportunities of some of these. And I guess one of the interesting things I took away with is there are possibilities of being able to do stuff in some of these very, very challenging environments. But why would you? You know, you'd end up going there and digging a hole in underground, because that's the only way you could survive. So unless you're out there to do something pretty impressive and pretty valuable, the concept is really not that that practical. So I like the way the book is structured, because basically the first couple of chapters, you look at it and you think, well, Christopher's definitely putting out all the challenges and all the difficulties of particularly human spaceflight. You know, some of the things like, well, what are some of the reasons we've been using or trying to rationalise human spaceflight? You know, human settlement, overpopulation, running out of resources, all of these types of things. Now, in many cases, he doesn't believe the human overpopulation is ever going to be to to a level where it could be solved by hit by off Earth population. So it's not really going to happen. One of the things I really like, he goes through the health issues associated with spaceflight, and goes into quite a deep dive into those. And in one at one stage, he lists. So I've got a list here. It's 34 dangers of living and working in space. So we all know about radiation and all the other types of things. One of the things that he does talk about is zero G, and zero G, in his words, is the enemy of human spaceflight. You've got to get out of there to have any possibility of being able to do anything reasonable for a long-term period and for a productive way of operating in space. So, and sadly, we've got facilities in space, zero G, and they do a bit of study, but they don't really look at, for example, long-term, either up there or on Earth, long-term moon-level gravity. Obviously, we're talking about, you know, hopefully, possibly 2024, maybe later, for the first human returns to the moon. But the amount of research done into long-term exposure to moon gravity, for if there were to be settlements and mining operations and that sort of thing, is really not there. So we would we'd be having to develop and understand that. Now, the moon is not quite so difficult because it is kind of a three-day trip away, so you know that's a possibility. One of the things he does talk about, and it has been mentioned quite a bit, is about radiation. And the sort of the catch-22 you run with deep space travel, of being protected from that. Now, there's ways of protecting yourself from radiation in space and on Earth, big lumps of lead, thick walls full of water, all of that type of thing. But, of course, in space, how do you possibly justify the fuel involved in getting tons and tons of lead or water into space and having it sitting there to be your insulator? So, you know, these are all things that really need to be looked at, and Christopher does look at it with different technologies and possibilities of one of the things that could be used mining on the moon is getting water ice, water from the moon. But, you know, there's challenges there. It's deep at the bottom of craters in the southern hemisphere of the moon. Probably extremely ultra rock hard. The energy required to get it to a form that's usable for fuel, drinking, air, all that type of thing. Huge challenges. So, as I say, I do like the way that Christopher has taken this skeptic's approach, but then backed it out towards the middle of the book and towards the back of the book of saying, well, okay, let's set aside some things, or let's assume that the particularly private business sees a return on investment in order to be able to, for example, produce water on the moon. There might be a business, you know, Joe's Lunar Water, that says, I'm going to invest X billion dollars and I'm going to sell it to the Russians, the Chinese, the Americans, the Australians for their moon bases. Well, that might be a business model that works, and it might produce results. There's a lot of ifs there, of course. Yeah, I like the book. It's very easy to... It's aimed at the space interested, not the space expert. So you can get a good understanding of what... really clarifying what is the problem. I mean, go back to zero-G. Obviously, we do live and work in space in zero-G. But people possibly don't realise that these astronauts spend 2 to 3 hours every day just exercising, and it doesn't even go to fully mitigate the negative effects of zero G on the body. For example, obviously there's muscles, but there's calcium in the bones, other areas. There's even an eyesight issue where the human eye becomes distorted and permanently, in some cases, affected. Even after you've been back on the ground for 2 or 3 years, a lot of these astronauts have eyesight problems. So once again, you know, to semi to paraphrase him, getting out of zero G in space is a high, high priority. So, of course, there's ways of doing that, but it's also challenges of how you do it engineering wise and weight versus fuel and capabilities or practicalities to get that type of equipment up into space. One of the things I really like about the book, and please jump in, Andrew, if you've got any comments on this, is that he sort of talks about, you know, the why, how, and when do we want to go into space and settle or mine in space. You know, there's no shortage of ideas about going to the moon, Mars, and elsewhere, each with its particular advantage and disadvantages. It's difficulty of answering the why question with a rationale of why, of really what's it to do. And there's typically been, in Chris's words, three sort of motivations to do it. There's political, there's military, or there's basically prestige in the sense of pleasing an authority. For example, you could probably talk about, you know, North Korea, for example. The political, obviously, that really demonstrated itself in the Apollo era, where, you know, they amassed a big program and spent ludicrous amounts of money to make it happen, because it was a strategic, political, and military. Don't forget, Apollo was very, very military, even though it was run by NASA and organized and controlled by NASA. But the military backing behind it, support within the military, within the population, you know, while the military didn't send that money to NASA to do it, the Congress and the congressional support, really the unwritten line there was that it's a military demonstration to the world and to the Soviet Union at the time that America was superior. So Chris goes into a lot of those areas as well, which I really like. I'll take a break, Andrew. Can I ask you if you concur with some of my thoughts there?
Yes. Well, I independently of you, Peter, have read the book and written my review. So I'll go through that and then we'll discuss perhaps points of commonality or difference. So sure. I thought the book is easy to read. It's written in layman's language, yet it's insightful and clearly explained. It's thought-provoking on a range of issues. It details the difficulties of space exploration and settlement, then offers practical solutions. I did spot one error, though. It says the X-37B launch was in 2010, not in 2012, as Christopher says. I know, because I was there. X-37B is a reusable space plane that the United States Air Force uses. Now, typically, in a book of this nature, one expects dozens of mistakes, so that if someone knowledgeable about space like myself only spots one error, he's doing...
I found one or two myself, but yeah, not worth mentioning.
Yeah, okay. First in the book, he skewers the idealistic and rosy visions shown in science fiction films and books as being totally unrealistic. And to quote from the first page, most plans for space settlements look good on paper and in animated videos, but the devil is in the details, end quote. Christopher Wojcik unpicks President Nixon's post-Apollo space policy and pops Kennedy's pro Apollo bubble. And so he asks, why have we not done more since Apollo? And he answers, human space exploration turned out to be much more difficult and expensive than we ever anticipated. End of quote. Nixon said, and I quote, what we do in space from here on in must become a normal and regular part of our national life. End of quote. Unfortunately, this ended up as an inefficient bureaucracy, a government-funded space program that lacked the necessary directives, fiscal discipline, and managerial leadership to deliver results. Now, in many places in the book, Christopher damns the space shuttle as a huge, expensive mistake. He explains how it spiraled into a cycle of increasing costs and decreasing efficiency. Now, ever since the 1970s, human flight to Mars has been 2 decades away, and it still is. Over the past 50 years, we have had only advances in animation to make it look easy. He sees a change happening now with commercial investment and actual products. He criticizes many futurists and space enthusiasts, pointing out that few ever delve into the why we should settle the moon or Mars, who should pay for it, and how. He points out that nations or individuals will part with large sums of cash for big projects for the 3 reasons that Peter has just mentioned: praise of deity or royalty, for war, or promise of economic return. And he goes on to provide examples of each. One might at first get the impression that Wojcik is negatively cataloguing the cons of space travel. But he does so to explain how space travel, moon and Mars bases, can realistically happen. He plays out a pathway forward that avoids the mistakes of the past and obeys the laws of economics and physics. Unlike many futurists that paint a rosy vision with no detail, Wojcik burrows down into the nitty-gritty of what would be needed to achieve this future. Yes, he says, there are obstacles, but he shows how they can be surmounted. He is scathing of the much-publicized Mars One, which planned to establish Martian settlements by sending people on a one-way trip to Mars. He says this 2012 proposal was either an elaborate hoax or an earnest project destined to fail. And Elon Musk's plan for sending 100 people to Mars in a large spacecraft is only marginally more practical, says Wojcik. Now, one section of the book was surprisingly interesting. It was a perceptive and detailed story of the Biosphere 2 in Arizona in the 1990s. That's where a team of biospherans sealed themselves off in a giant glasshouse and tried to grow sufficient food and oxygen to survive indefinitely. He explains what happened there and suggests what they might have done instead. Another little point here. There's one page on sex in space. Now, unlike the late Kate Doolan, Wojcik is sure that no one has done it yet. And you read the book to find out why. At the end of most chapters, Wojcik sticks his neck out and makes his own prediction of what will happen. Now, one does not expect a book written by an American to use SI, that is International System Units of Measure. But Wojcik is all over the shop with his units. For example, in distances, there are meters, feet, and miles, areas in square feet and square meters, temperatures in Celsius and Fahrenheit, and all mixed up, and I could go through a whole list of these. But don't let this criticism put you off. Christopher Wojcik's Spacefarers is a darn good read. And the book is supported by 22 pages of references and a detailed index. It's published this year by Harvard University Press. It is available from the Book Depository, Dimmicks, Readings, Booktopia, and elsewhere. Booktopia has an e-book version, whilst Audible has an audiobook. Now, Christopher Wojcik's Spacefarers is not to be confused with Michael Neufeld's 2013 book of the same name. So back to you, Peter.
Yeah, I concur, Andrew. He makes some pretty interesting points, actually. One thing I really liked, it was earlier in the book, he's basically saying, and I'll read word for word, it's illegal for the United States to send a human to Mars. The reason is that the expected radiation exposure for an astronaut, a federal worker, far exceeds the levels permitted by the workplace activities by the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration. China could do it, Russia could do it, but they don't have the pesky regulations that the US does. So at this stage, legally speaking, they can't. And also, you mentioned back during the Apollo 16 and Apollo 17 missions back in 1972, there was a very, very large solar storm that came out. And if that had taken place while the astronauts were in space, they would have very likely received almost lethal doses of radiation, so they dodged a bullet there. So obviously on the way to Mars or somewhere like that, there's definitely going to need to be protection provided for them. And how practical that is, once again, with the equation of rocketry, unless some dramatic changes happen. And actually, that's one thing he does mention towards the end of the book, is other types of propulsion systems. Goes in quite a bit of depth. There has been some experiments which have shown some promise. So for people that are interested in that part of the equation or part of the system, it's quite a nice part as well. And as you say, the predictions he makes are quite sound, actually. One thing he is sceptical of, though, in near term, he's sceptical of near-term initiatives, which I think we all probably would agree, like the Artemis program to return to the humans by 2024. He basically says that ain't going to happen by that time frame, and you know, it's falling into the same stop-start. Let's quickly do this something so I can, you know, win the election, beat the Soviets, whatever you want to put, whatever you want to put your stamp on it, is basically the killer of a long-term, systematic system to build a sustainable space program. Now, the beauty of those countries that don't have those pesky things called elections, like China, is that they can do that, and it's fairly good evidence that they are taking their time, going very slowly, but building on their capabilities. So, once again, they don't have to worry about getting re-elected. In fact, I think Xi Jinping's there for life, isn't he? So I think he's pretty comfortable. I bet you Donald Trump would love to have that option available to him. You never know, he might put a proposal through. So I think the book is a really good read. It's timely, particularly we're on the cusp of Artemis and the other things that are happening in the commercial space sphere, which he strongly supports and believes, once again, really, unless there's an overriding need, or I mean, one of the things he uses as a thread through the book is rivalry with China. I guess overlaying that with the old rivalry with the Soviet Union might be a factor in causing administrations of countries to make the necessary injection of funds and commitment over the long term to produce a result. I think what he's trying to say is really there's better ways to do that, and I think we probably agree, rather than trying to do two parallel or separate things against each other, is to get a business case up to allow businesses to jump in and say, well, here's an opportunity. We can build this system. We can get the system up and running. Once again, as I mentioned before, an example is getting to the moon and being the water guy to sell to, you know, whether there's commercial bases or whether there's research bases. And he does refer to a lot of the comparison to the Antarctic bases, which Antarctica is not owned by anybody, but it's been sectioned off into groups of areas that are managed and operated by certain countries. And he believes that that's probably the model that is going to eventuate for the moon. But once again, if those Antarctic bases, they don't really operate in an isolated way. They have supplies flowing in and out continuously to keep them running. So that would probably be the case for the early stages of these bases, particularly on the moon. But if they were able to get to a point where they were semi-self-sufficient, he believes that would be a great benefit. I did mention the movie The Martian, which he quite liked, but acknowledged, like everyone, I think, there's a lot of technical things that they brushed over and decided not to address for the entertainment value. One of the things he does say is there ain't going to be growing any potatoes in the Martian soil, because they would be completely toxic if they were in fact able to be grown. There's these things called perchlorates in the Martian regolith, which is pretty bad for humans.
All right, well, Peter, thank you. Stay on the line, because you're going to tell us about the Space Association meeting, and then we have a giveaway. So just hang on there.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
And we are in conversation on the Space Show with Peter Owood, the president of the Space Association of Australia. Now, Peter, Space Association has a meeting coming up this coming Monday. Tell us all about it, please.
That's right, yes. Due to coronavirus, we've had to go to virtual meetings, which we've been doing since, I think, March or even February, I don't know, since forever. So, yeah, we've got another virtual meeting on Monday, 7.30 to 9.30, although we often hang around for an extra hour afterwards having a chat and sharing stories and information. So, yeah, this meeting is available. We're using the Zoom platform to run it. It's easy to join if you've got Zoom installed, or even if you don't, you can just run it by a web page. And the simplest way to do this is to go to our website, which is space.asn.au. Click on the link and it'll take you to the meeting. And you just need to register. What we're doing is making these people register so we don't get these, you know, hackers come in and, you know, show inappropriate things. So what you do is you simply go to the website, go to that link, read through, click on the register button. They'll ask you then to pop in your name and your email address. Once you hit submit, you get sent back an email, which is a link to start the Zoom session. So once again, the session is 7.30 to 9.30 p.m. on Monday the 28th. What we do is we'll have everyone muted as you join, but there will be an opportunity to ask a question. But what we do, there's a link in there for another platform called Slido, which is a web page. And you can just go into Slido and ask a question. So what happens is we can read those questions to the speakers. We've got three speakers. I'm one of them. I'm doing a pre-US election space policy review. So trying to capture kind of where the Trump-Biden positions on space for the next administration is or might be. So it's a lot of speculation. I've tried to gather all the bits and pieces I know. Often there will be other ideas and other people will contribute that information. Then we're going to go, that's till 8 p.m, and then we're going to go to a Space Down Under report from this YouTube reporter who's based in Brisbane called Josh Keegan. He does these excellent videos. And he's going to be in conversation with Nick Green, the CEO of PFI Aerospace. It looks fantastic, fascinating. So please make sure you come along and be watching that. And then we go to 8.45. We have the author, Christopher Wanjack, live from Baltimore in the US. It's quite early in the morning for him, but he's very willing and able to get up. I did a test chat with him the other morning, and he's a lovely bloke and very enthusiastic. So he's really looking forward to this. He's got a really nice presentation. I've just seen a couple of slides, which kind of takes you through a taster of his book. I think people really enjoy that. So once again, on Monday the 28th at 7.30 to 9.30 p.m. After the event, the whole meeting is put up on our YouTube channel. So if you didn't catch any of it or all of it, you can go ahead and watch that. Yeah.
So I just point out that to participate in this, you need to have a computer or an iPad or a telephone, you know, smartphone capable of Zoom.
Running the Zoom program, yeah.
Yes.
Which most anything you bought in the last 5 years will be fine. we'll also during that. As people may or may know, the Space Association is a member group, and people pay an annual subscription to be a member. And if you are a member listening to this now, you can go into a draw to win a copy of the book. We'll draw that on the night, on Monday night. That's well worth a listen. So you don't have to be listening at the time. If you just go to that webpage I spoke of, and if you are a member, click on the Get Ticket, and you'll ask for your membership details. You log in, and then you put your expression of interest in there to win the book. So that's exciting.
And we have a offer here for listeners to The Space Show on Southern FM.
That's Andrew?
Yeah, we have one copy.
That's for next week.
The book offer?
That's for next week, Andrew.
Oh, my mistake.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, your mistake.
I'm in a time warp here. It's September the 23rd today. So
that's great, yeah.
The Space Show is giving away a book next week.
The radio show, correct? Yes.
Yeah.
If you're a member and you can get the win a copy on Monday night, you can get a second chance on Wednesday night.
Okay, then. So, well, thank you, Peter, for joining us on the Space Show.
My pleasure.
All right.
Have a great evening, everyone.
Okay, then. And we'll just head out now with some of that enthusiastic music about coming to Mars, which Crystal Wunjik thinks is a little fanciful.
To the end.
That was Marissa Donahue and John Bodie with To Thee Great Hope. And it was music submitted to the Mars Society to promote an interest in humans going to Mars, something that Krista Wunjik there wrote about.